Okay.
So I'm very happy to have Robert Lander here, and he'll be talking about elliptic genus of singular surfaces.
Uh-huh. If I can get to there.
I had the same problem.
Hi, my name is Robert Welder. I want to talk about some recent work that I've done on defining smooth invariants of singular varieties, in particular of normal surface singularities. So let me just briefly recall. So, by the way, you can look up. I just recently posted this work on Archive. So if you just do a search for Welder, and then the paper's title is, what is the paper's title? Singular elliptic genus of normal surfaces. So recall the first of all, recall that one of the interesting applications of defining smooth invariants of singular surface of singular varieties is the mirror symmetry test. So recall briefly that essentially mirror symmetry is the observation that two different target manifolds in string theory can give rise to the same type of physics. And if M and M tilde, and excuse me, if M and M hat are mirror manifolds to each other, then you can tell there's a criterion to test whether these are actually mirror manifolds, which is called the topological mirror symmetry test, and says that the Hodge numbers of M and M hat have to be mirror to each other in the following sense. We have to have the HPQ of M is equal to H n minus P Q of M hat, where N is the dimension of M. The only problem with this test is that even if M is smooth, it may not be the case that M hat is smooth. So in this case, we have to figure out what do we mean by the topological mirror symmetry test. So we know from physics that if M hat has what's called a Krepent resolution. So this just means that X is a resolution of singularities, and the Jacobian of the map is trivial in the following sense, that Kx is equal to the pullback of Km hat. So of course, we have to assume that M hat is not too singular in the sense that at least the canonical bundle is something that can be pulled back. For example, we usually assume that the canonical bundle is a Cartier divisor or a Q-Cartier divisor. So if we have a Krepent resolution of singularities, meaning that there's no discrepancies when we meaning there's no discrepancies in the resolution of singularities, then we know from physics that the topological mirror symmetry test works if we replace this quantity with h n minus p q of x. So the next question is, what do you do if you don't have a Krepent resolution of singularities? So motivated by this question, Badirev, before I get into that, let me just point out that, in general, if we have a singular complex variety, we can actually always define the Hodge numbers using the following idea. So suppose that Z is complex variety. If we look at the compactly supported cohomology of Z with coefficients in C, so in particular, we're not assuming that Z is compact, then according to a deep result of Deligne, this compactly supported cohomology has a filtration on it, which gives rise to a notion of a mixed Hodge structure. And we can use this filtration to therefore define Hodge numbers HPQ of Z. And these Hodge numbers satisfy some very nice properties. Probably the nicest property is that they're additive over stratifications in the following sense. If we take W, a closed subvariety of Z, then HPQ of Z minus W equals HPQ of Z minus HPQ of W. So this actually makes these Hodge numbers of complex varieties rather easy to compute in a lot of interesting situations. So, motivated by a sense of the world being a fair and just place, we might be tempted to think that these are the right ideas for Hodge numbers in the topological mirror symmetry test. Unfortunately, life isn't that fair, because if Z has some crepant resolution of singularities, it may not be the case that HPQ of Z, this may not be equal to HPQ of the crepant resolution. So in these situations, this naive idea of how to do the topological mirror symmetry test fails. So we have to be a bit more clever in making sense of Hodge numbers in this situation. So motivated by this problem, Badirev proposed the following generalization of Hodge numbers. So first of all, let me just point out that it's usually more convenient, instead of looking at Hodge numbers individually, to just collect them all into a single polynomial called the E function. So recall that the E polynomial of a variety Z is just sometimes you put a negative sign in front of things, but it doesn't really matter for our purposes. The sum of HPQ of Z, U to the P, V to the Q. And so obviously this just encodes all the data that we're interested in. Badirev proposed defining the following generalization of the E polynomial, which is called the stringy E polynomial of Z. And it's defined as follows. You take a resolution of singularity Z, which is a log resolution, which means that the exceptional subvarieties of the resolution are divisors, and the divisors intersect are smooth and intersect each other transversally. Technically, you'd say that they're divisors with simple normal crossings. And you look at the data of the discrepancies of the resolution. That is, we can write the Jacobian of the map as some sum of smooth divisors AI DI. And then the stringy E function of Z is defined by the following formula using the data of X and the divisors. It's assume these divisors are indexed by I. It's going to be the sum over all subsets J of I of the E function of this guy, which I'll define in a second, times this product . Okay, so what is DJ interior? This is just sort of the generic intersection of divisors indexed by J. That is, you take all the divisors indexed by J, take their intersection, and then subtract off all the other divisors. So it's some open, smooth subvariety. and then we multiply everything by this product over the indexing set J. So if you haven't seen this before, this definition probably looks really opaque. And this string E function actually has a rather simple description, or at least an elegant description, in terms of motivic integration theory. The way you'd really define the string E function is you look at the space of all locally defined curves in X, or the space of germs of arcs on X. And if we have some curve, say gamma, passing through some point P, then these divisors define in a nice sort of canonical way a function on this space of arcs. So if we have some divisor, then the divisor evaluated at this locally defined curve is just the multiplicity of gamma along D at P. And if we give the right kind of measure to the space of arcs, then we can, these divisors give rise to nice measurable functions, and then we can define an integration theory associated to this measure, and we can express the data of the string E function in terms of some simple integral involving these functions defined on the space of arcs of X. So this was all motivated by Konsevich's p-adic integration theory. And if you do the integral, and what the nice thing about these integrals is that you can actually do them in certain situations, you get some formula like this. The nice thing about this formula, though, is, or at least working with stringy invariants, is once you believe the formula is a good idea, you don't need to worry too much about the motivic integration theory behind it. In any event, natural thing that comes to mind is this obviously seems to depend a great deal on the choice of the log resolution. And in fact, it does not. For example, if you can imagine doing a blow-up of X along some subvariety and looking at the Jacobian associated to this new resolution of singularities, you obviously get different discrepancy divisors, and you might ask, well, do we get the same thing back if we define the string E function using the data upstairs? And you can think of this almost like a change of variables formula, because here we're sort of changing the Jacobian of the map. And sure enough, the independence of the choice of log resolution follows from the change of variables formula in motivic integration theory. So I don't mean to, that's sort of a difficult theorem to prove, but at least you get a sense of why viewing this in terms of motivic integration can be an advantage to understanding the properties of it.
But can you also understand it if you just...
Yes, but then you're kind of stuck. So what you could do is you could prove by brute force that this was invariant under blow-up. The problem with doing it that way is that then, see, here's the main issue, is you take Z and take two log resolutions, X and Y. There's sort of two ways you can kind of show that you get the same answer. I think maybe the simplest thing to do is take the Hironaka Hut for X and Y, and then use the change of variables formula from motivic integration to show that this guy is equal to this guy, and the string E function using the data here is equal to the string E function using the data here.
But then you are still using motivic integration.
Right. So if you use what you suggested, then you have to use another theorem. Another thing you can do is you can use the fact that every birational map is a sequence of blow-ups and blowdowns. But I consider that as sort of a deep theorem of Lodarczyk. A deeper theorem, I believe, than simply using motivic integration theory. But yes, you could take some sort of sequence, x0, x1, etc. until you got to x. And just then, if you allow yourself to use the weak factorization theorem of Lodarczyk, then certainly this is you can prove you're reduced to simply showing that this is invariant under blow-up, and I agree that is a rather simple computation, but the trade-off is that you have to use this deep result of Lodarczyk. So does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so where was I? Okay, so then, of course, once we define the stringy E function in this way, all we have to do is we can expand everything in powers of U and V, take the coefficients of U to the P, V to the Q, and that will be what we think of as the stringy Hodge numbers of Z. And of course, it may happen that we get rational coefficients in front of the u to the p's, v to the q's. If kz is not Cartier but q Cartier, we may get sort of a rational notion of Hodge numbers. But in any event, Badyarev showed that this is actually the right extension of Hodge numbers. That is, the topological mirror symmetry test works when you use this notion of Hodge numbers for certain nice singularities. Incidentally, you can already see that if X is a log resolution which happens to be a Krepin resolution, you can immediately see that this gives you back the E function of the Krepin resolution, because all the AIs are just zero. The only subset here is the null set, so we just have the E function of the total space. And even if we just take a Krepin resolution, which is not a log resolution, we still get back the E function of the Krepin resolution, because what you can do is, if the Krepin resolution happens not to be a log resolution, well, then you just blow it up enough so that it becomes a log resolution, and then you can use the change of variables formula to compare the stringy E function using the data upstairs to the just ordinary E function, the Krepin resolution.
So now the right mirror symmetry test is E of M equals E stringy of M
hat. Yeah. HPQ of M equals H N minus P Q string of M hat.
And can you say that in terms of the E function?
Yeah, I mean, it would just be these are just the coefficients of the U's and V's in the E function.
But then don't you get different powers?
I'm sorry, where?
With the P replaced by N minus P. Never mind. Sorry, I think I'm asking something.
Different weight on the U and V variables.
You'd look at whatever was the power U to the N minus P in the stringy E function.
Oh, yeah, this is what I meant. Yeah, so the stringy the E functions are not equal, just the coefficients of certain powers.
I must confess that I don't know a huge amount about this part of it. What I really wanted to do was motivate some of the things that I'm going to talk about later, because outside of this context, everything seems to come out of nowhere. Okay, so... and then one other thing I wanted to kind of mention is that this is useful for more than just the topological mirror symmetry test. It's also useful for the McKay correspondence. So let me briefly discuss that. So suppose we have some variety V and a finite group acting on V. Then we can think of V mod G in two different ways. we can think of it as an orbifold, or we can think of it as some singular variety with some resolution of singularities. So in particular, let's assume that it has a crepant resolution of singularities. So kx equals the pullback, kv mod g. Then in physicists basically predict that the physics associated to V mod G as an orbifold should be the same in some sense as the physics of the crepant resolution. And another way to think of this is mathematically is in terms of the McKay correspondence, which essentially for our purposes here can be understood as saying that orbifold invariants of V together with the group action G should be equivalent in some sense to invariants of the crepant resolution. So for example, lots of classical invariants, for example, the Euler characteristic or the E function, have orbifold analogs. For example, the which are defined just in terms of the data of V and the action of G on V. For example, if we just take Euler characteristic, then I'll just explicitly tell you what the McKay correspondence is in this case, on the numerical level at least. If we define the orbifold Euler characteristic of the pair VG to be the sum 1 over G times the sum over all commuting pairs of the Euler characteristic of the common fixed point locus of G and H. So this definition is motivated from string theory, and it is in some sense the right notion of Euler characteristic when you're dealing with things in an orbifold sense. Then it turns out that this, assuming that some technical constraints on G, that the ramification divisor of G acting on V is trivial, this is actually equal to the actual Euler characteristic of the crepant resolution. And this point of view of the McKay correspondence is rather robust with respect to invariants. I mean, replace, for example, there is an analogous notion of orbifold E function, and the McKay correspondence in that case tells you that that orbifold E function happens to be the E function of the crepant resolution. And using this notion of stringy E function, Batyrev was able to prove the McKay correspondence for the E function. And essentially the idea is that it's very hard to just work with the crepant resolution. It would be much nicer to have a definition that would just work for any log resolution. That way you could just, I mean, essentially what you do is you look at V goes to V mod G. You can always find a new pair of maps, say y hat and y, or maybe I shouldn't use hat because I was using it for mirror symmetry, but say y to x. We can always sort of form this kind of diagram where the vertical arrows are resolutions of singularities, and this horizontal arrow is birational to this global quotient. And moreover, we can require that these are log resolutions and that this map locally looks like a map of toric varieties. And then the idea of Batyrev is that you can replace your computations down here with computations up here and reduce everything to the toric case. But in order to do that, you have to be able to have this freedom to work with sort of whatever log resolution you desire. And that's where this definition becomes very useful. Okay, so having given you background on that, let me now move on to other smooth invariants of singular varieties. How many? Yeah.
Was that conjecture improvement that you just did?
Yes, that was on the numerical level there. That's proven by. Oh, sorry. What did I realized I erased
something. Just look at the twerk stuff.
I'm sorry.
That you could just look at the twerk.
Oh yeah. Essentially, you take. There's several ways you can do this. The way that maybe is the simplest is you take V goes to V mod G, and you take the normalization of you take a log resolution Z, and you take the normalization of Z in the function field of V, I think. And then that'll give you a map which is called a. That'll give you another map, Z hat, where this map is now what's called a toroidal embedding. And essentially, it looks locally like a map of toric varieties. And then, after some more resolutions of singularities, toroidal resolutions of singularities, you can get this to be smooth and a toroidal embedding. Another thing you can do is take V. Here you have G acting on it, and you can just keep blowing up V so that you get the point where the stabilizers of the group action are abelian. And then you can see, so just do a whole bunch of blow-ups, so you get something like V tilde. So this is called, this is Batyrev's approach, it's called canonical abelianization. So you just do a whole bunch of blow-ups until the stabilizers become abelian. And then you can see that when you quotient out by G, you're, in some sense, it has this local structure of being quotient by an abelian group, so that looks like a toric variety. So, does that? Okay. So you see, because you're either way, you're sort of doing a whole bunch of blow-ups. Therefore, you need something that's kind of has some nice functoriality property with respect to blow-ups. And E function has that property. The stringy E function has that property. If you think about it, we would call this guy right here, forgetting about Z, just look at the data of X in this divisor. We could call that the E function of this pair. So when I mean it has nice functoriality properties, I mean with respect to pullbacks of pairs. Okay, so how am I doing on time? I feel like I'm really taking a lot of time here. Oh, it's not so bad. Okay, so having done that, let's move on to the elliptic genus. So if you think about it, the E function is, in some sense, a generalization of Euler characteristic, right? And it's the generalization that you get by refining the cohomology groups using the mixed Hodd structure. So what is another way to extend Euler characteristic? Well, you can think of Euler characteristic as the integral of the top Chern class of the holomorphic tangent bundle. And so another way of generalizing this invariant is just look at more combinations of Chern numbers. So that justifies my introducing the elliptic genus. So the elliptic genus is a number of ways of justifying its existence. or justifying looking at it, it arises in physics as a partition function in superconformal field theory. And it's given by the following formula. Suppose that X is a complex manifold, and we'll assume compact. So I'm going to let Tx be the holomorphic tangent bundle with formal churn roots Xi. Oh, wait, I don't erase that. Then the elliptic genus is given by the following integral. It's integral over the churn roots of xi, product of xi, theta of xi over 2 pi I minus z comma tau over theta of xi over 2 pi I tau. So here, theta of t tau is the Jacobi theta function. So roughly speaking, it's something like sine of pi times t times the product 1 minus q to the n e to the 2 pi I t 1 minus q to the n e to the minus 2 pi I t. Or here q equals e to the 2 pi I tau. So tau is in the upper half plane. I will never write this like this again because it takes too long, so if I ever refer to the elliptic genus again, I'm going to omit the 2 pi i's and omit the tau's, but they're still there. And of course, what do we mean? I'm sorry?
What's the z?
Oh, yeah, z is just some complex variable. So you can already see that this generalizes, for example, the Euler characteristic. If you were to let z, for example, go to 0, then this part just cancels with this, and we get the integral of the top churn class. And the elliptic genus, if you specialize the parameters z and tau to other numbers, you can reproduce all kinds of interesting topological invariants, for example, the signature, or if you let q go to 0, you actually get something that encodes the Herzberg-Chi-Y genus. Recall that the Herzberg-Chi-Y genus is given by product xi 1 minus e to the 2 pi I. Well, I'll write it as 1 minus y e to the minus xi for 1 minus e to the minus xi. So if we think of y as being e to the 2 pi I z, then if we let, this is essentially a sine function with a z in there and divided by like a sine function. And you can see there, therefore, that you're going to get back essentially the same thing if you let q go to 0 in the expression for the elliptic genus. So, at least if you thought this was a crazy thing to define, at least this justifies that it allows you, it sort of encodes a whole bunch of different interesting topological and algebra geometric invariants all at once. And what's very useful about the elliptic genus is that we can use the modularity properties of the Jacobi theta function to get all sorts of interesting information about the elliptic genus, and that allows us to discover things about the classical topological invariants that you'd never be able to notice if it weren't for putting them all together inside this theta function. So, given the success of Batyrev's approach, well, before I go on, are there any questions? Okay. So, given the success of Batyrev's approach of generalizing Hodge numbers for singular varieties, it's natural to ask, can we do something like this for the elliptic genus? In fact, I think it's just a general rule of thumb. If something can be done for the Chi-Y genus, there should be a way to do it for the elliptic genus. And of course, the Chi-Y genus is encoded by the EPAW number. So, in fact, one can define in a similar way McKay correspondence for the elliptic genus. There's an orbifold definition of elliptic genus. And the McKay correspondence should continue to hold in that situation. In fact, it does and was proven by Borisov and Lipgaber by using an approach to defining the singular elliptic genus in a way that was analogous to Batyrev's approach with stringy E functions. So, let me introduce singular elliptic genus. So this is introduced by Borisov, Lipgaber, and Chin-Lung Wang. Borisov and Lipgaber were motivated by proving the McKay correspondence for the elliptic genus. And Chin-Lung Wang was motivated by proving that K equivalent, or at least he certainly used it for this purpose, used this notion of singular elliptic genus to prove that K equivalent varieties have the same elliptic genus. So K equivalent means that I have X and Y, and I can find some common birational morphism so that the pullback of the canonical bundle of X is equal to the pullback of the canonical bundle of Y. In particular, birational Calabi-Yau varieties have the same elliptic genus. So the definition is given as follows. You start the same way. You take your log resolution with the data of the Jacobian being this divisor with simple normal crossings. And you proceed by, you start out with the same formula as before, where I warn you that I'm omitting the tau and the 2 pi i's just because it gets too cluttered. You start out with the same formula as before, but now you introduce kind of a Jacobian factor, which this factor, I don't know, it seems to scare everybody in my seminar, but it doesn't seem like such a bad thing after you stare at it for a year. So you have to introduce some factor to account for the divisors. Again, we see that if the AIs are zero, then this factor is, just becomes, right? We just have a 1 here and a 1 here, so this just becomes multiplication by 1, and you get back the elliptic genus of X itself. So
what do you mean by theta of DI?
Oh, I'm sorry, I meant to say that. Of course, by DI we just mean, DI is just shorthand for first Chern class of the line bundle associated to DI.
Oh, okay.
sorry. So again, one has to show that this is independent of the choice of log resolution. And the way you would do it is you, this time there's no way out. You have to use the weak factorization theorem. As far as I know, I don't know any other way of proving this. So what you have to do essentially is show that this satisfies a nice functoriality property with respect to a blow-up, and then use the, which is not entirely trivial in and of itself, and then you have to use the weak factorization theorem to show that any right, because if you take another resolution of Z, you want to connect X to Y by a sequence of blow-ups and blow-downs, and since the elliptic genus using this formula has that nice functoriality property, then at each stage in the blow-up you will get the same answer, so that shows that it doesn't depend on the choice of log resolution. And it may not be too surprising that a technique that's probably a lot of people don't realize is similar in spirit, because I'm not sure how many people have actually read this paper, but Borisov and Libgaber use this definition in a way that was rather analogous to the use of the stringy E function in Badirev's proof of the McKay correspondence to prove the McKay correspondence for the elliptic genus. Essentially, it comes down to you want to pick log resolutions that you want to replace the map V goes to V mod G with a map that looks, that is birational to the global quotient, but has this local structure of a toric variety. There's a little bit more to it than that, but that's essentially the idea. So now, having introduced these...
So I have a question.
Yeah.
For the elliptic genus, there's also like the physics motivation from looking at the sigma model from
yes.
an elliptic curve into mm-hmm. the manifold. Is that what you get if you try to do the same thing for an orbifold?
I think you get the orbifold elliptic genus then, in that case.
Oh, okay. But this formula hasn't appeared in physics.
Not to my knowledge, but
okay.
I'm sure there's something to it. I look at it as like an intermediate step. I think the physicists can make sense of orbifold elliptic genus, and I think they can make sense of the elliptic genus of the Krepent resolution, and this kind of forms a bridge of a way to connect the two, but I don't know what this means just by itself physically. But I do think that, and we'll see later maybe some motivation for trying to find such a interpretation. I do think that that would be an important thing to try to figure out. I don't think I know enough physics to propose such an interpretation. Although I should say, it's interesting that... never mind. I was about to say something that was wrong. So.
In the case of orbifold, it agrees with the orbifold. Right.
Yes, this is, so if we call this E sing of Z, then assuming some technical constraints, namely that the ramification divisor of the group action is trivial, then the L sing, excuse me, the singular elliptic genus of V mod G in that case is equal to the orbifold elliptic genus of VG, where here orbifold elliptic genus is defined using a complicated expression that is in some sense very much analogous to the expression I gave for orbifold E function. I don't think it's enlightening to write it on the board though. Assuming that again that the ramification divisor of G on V is trivial, and if that's not the case, then there's a more general version of the McKay correspondence, which indeed still holds. So this is proven by Borisov and Libgaber, and I proved also an equivariant version of this, which gives an interesting formula in the case where we're looking at the Hilbert scheme of points on an open surface. But in any event, having introduced this, I want to discuss some limitations of these approaches. First of all, there's an obvious limitation in that we always have to be able to pull back the canonical bundle of a singular variety. That's not such a big deal. We'll just assume that the singular variety has a Q-cardioid canonical divisor. I think the more interesting limitation is notice that if the AJs in this case, if any of them are equal to negative 1, we find ourselves having to divide by 0. And similarly, if one of these AIs is equal to negative 1, again, well, theta of 0 is 0, so we'd have to divide by 0. And I find this actually very interesting because despite their similarity in the usefulness of both approaches of Batyrev and Borisov-Libgaber, these are two very different points of view. Nevertheless, they both hit, you know, the same exact wall. What do you do when some of the discrepancy coefficients are equal to negative 1? So, and I want to emphasize that this is, it's a bigger problem than you'd think of at first. Not only do we have to assume that all the coefficients are not equal to negative 1, we actually have to assume that all the discrepancy coefficients are greater than negative 1, which is called the log terminality condition. So why is it bad? Why do we have to assume AI is greater than negative 1? The issue is this. Or is it obvious why we have to assume greater than negative 1? Okay, good. And if it is obvious, well, let's pretend it's not for a sec. The issue is this. How would we show that the resolution was independent of the choice of log resolution? Suppose we allowed ourselves to look at resolutions which had discrepancy coefficients just not equal to negative 1, but some could be bigger, some could be smaller. The problem is, when we try to connect x and y by a sequence of blow-ups and blow-downs, the coefficients can recombine in a way to produce a negative 1, and then you wouldn't have any way to compare them, which I think is really problematic because a priori, just given this definition, it doesn't seem like there should be any reason why the definition shouldn't be well defined as long as some AIs are not equal to, as long as the AIs aren't equal to negative 1. So I find this a bit mysterious, and especially because they don't give any, neither Borisov, Libgaber, or Batyrev really gives any explanation of why this fails in that case. Borisov and Libgaber offer the following. It's interesting to note that this is all they really had to say on it, maybe just because it wasn't interesting to them, but they said, well, you know, we're not really sure what the real reason for this is, but they suggested looking at the case where we have a simple elliptic surface singularity. So that is, we have a torus which collapses to a point. And in this case, this is an example where we have just one exceptional divisor with discrepancy coefficient equal to negative 1. And they said, well, maybe this has something to do with it because it's a torus. And interestingly enough, this, I'm pretty sure, has absolutely nothing to do with it. So let me tell you, because in this situation, actually, it turns out you can still define the elliptic genus. So let me show you some of partial. Let me discuss first what Borisov, Libgaber, and Willem Weiss have proposed to do to resolve this problem. And I'll discuss briefly the limitations of these approaches and what I've done towards this end. So first, let's look at Borisov and Libgaber's idea, which is rather simple. And you may have thought of it while you were listening, which is, why don't we just introduce a perturbation in the coefficients and take the limit as the perturbation goes to zero? And you could do this in several ways. You could just simply replace each ai with ai plus epsilon bi and let epsilon go to zero. Problem with this approach is that the definition, even if the limit exists, it's not clear that it satisfies any nice functoriality properties. So for that reason, Borisov and Libgaber, let's just look at surface singularities to make things simple. They proposed, well, introduce some ample divisor which crosses through all our normal surface singularities. And instead of looking at kx minus the pullback of kz, look at kx minus the pullback of kz plus epsilon h. In this situation, well, since h crosses through all the surface singularities, the epsilon is going to get introduced in front of all our discrepancy coefficients, and then we can take the limit as epsilon goes to zero. The problem with this approach is, well, there are several problems. One, the limit just doesn't exist in lots of situations. When the limit does exist, it's not at all clear what it converges to. And I can certainly vouch for if you do some perturbation along the lines of just adding an epsilon times bi, insanely and annoyingly enough, it depends on how you pick the perturbation. You get different answers if you pick the perturbation in different ways. So, not for every case, but for some cases. So this is not a very realistic solution. Again, I emphasize, even when everything works out, it's not at all clear what the limit converges to. So, interestingly enough, however, this approach does work for the normal surface singularity, for the elliptic surface singularity, although they don't mention this. I don't know why. Maybe it just seemed too crazy a singularity to bother with, but the limit actually, if you do this ample divisor approach, does converge and is independent of the choice of the ample divisor. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But now let me go on to discuss this stringy E function and a solution offered by a partial solution offered by Willem Weiss. So Willem Weiss gave a partial solution for normal, was able to define this, extend the stringy E function for almost all of the normal surface singularities. Namely, the ones which are not purely log canonical. So purely log canonical means all the AIs are greater than or equal to negative 1, and some of them are equal to negative 1. So if we're not in that situation, and that's just sort of a finite number of cases, then he was able to extend the notion of stringy Hodge numbers for those classes of normal surface singularities. And it's all based on the following really cute observation. Essentially, take your singular normal surface and look at the resolution, look at the exceptional curves of a log resolution. And suppose we have some chain that looks something like this, where here we have some curve C, which is a copy of P1. And then here we have a C1 and a C2. And we have discrepancy coefficients A1, A2, and A. Then let's ask, or he asked, what is the contribution of C to the stringy E function? Just assuming some discrepancy coefficient A. Well, if you go back to this definition, you see that the only indexing sets that matter, in other words, that would include C and therefore this discrepancy coefficient A, the only indexing sets which matter are the ones that include C by itself, C in C1, and C in C2. Now, these generic intersections give us C1 intersect C is a point, C2 intersect C is a point, and C generic is just C minus these two points is a copy of C star. Therefore, if we add up the contribution from this guy, and this guy, we'll get 1 times UV minus 1 over U to the A1 plus 1, All right, you know what? I'm going to write UV equal to L, and it'll just greatly simplify notation. And I'm going to write everything down here. So C1 intersect C gives us the contribution 1 times L minus 1 squared L to the A1 plus 1 minus 1 L to the A plus 1 minus 1 plus 1 times L minus 1 squared L to the A2 plus 1 minus 1 L to the A plus 1 minus 1. And finally, we have the contribution from the generic point in C, which is just, well, C star has E function L minus 1. So it's L minus 1 times L minus 1 over L to the A plus 1 minus 1. Write this all, combine all the terms, we get L minus 1 squared L to the A1 plus A2 plus 2 minus 1 over L to the A plus 1 minus 1 L to the A1 plus 1 minus 1, L to the A2 plus 1 minus 1. All right, so the only time we ever see a contribution from C, we just add all those contributions together, it just equals this. I'll leave it to you to do that algebra. Sure enough, it looks like if we let A go to negative 1, it looks like, again, we'd be dividing by 0, right? But the trick is to notice that by the adjunction formula, we can just compute that A1 plus A2 plus 2 is actually equal to minus the self-intersection number of C with itself times A plus 1, which I'll just call M times A plus 1. So if we realize that this exponent right here is just m times a plus 1, then this factor just cancels inside here. So we just get, sorry for jumping all over the board here, we just get L minus 1 squared L to the m minus 1 a plus 1 plus dot 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 plus 1 over L to the A1 plus 1 minus 1, L to the A2 plus 1 minus 1. In particular, letting A go to negative 1, the whole thing becomes just M times this divided by this. In particular, we can define it. So Willem Bass, so Willem Bass just proposed saying, okay, well, let's just let A equal to negative 1 here and define that to be the contribution whenever we see a negative 1 discrepancy coefficient, assuming that the only negative 1 discrepancy coefficients are curves that have this appearance in the resolution graph. Well, it turns out that's pretty much every situation except for the purely log-canonical normal surface singularities. And moreover, he was able to show that this is a good definition in the sense that it's invariant under the choice of log resolution and, you know, satisfies a number of other nice properties that you would want if you were going to call this the stringy E function. So let me now very quickly go over what I have done for the case of the elliptic genus for normal surface singularities. It would seem that since Willem Bass has defined stringy Hodge numbers, in particular he's defined the stringy Chi-Y genus for normal surface singularities, so it makes natural sense to ask, can you do something like this for the elliptic genus? Although, I think it's interesting that I didn't even know about this until I was already doing it for the elliptic genus. And in the process, you know, when you're doing something, you end up looking up other stuff and found this stuff and got scared because I thought he'd already done everything that I was doing. And I was amazed to discover that my approach actually reproduces sort of the same kind of stuff that he's doing. So it would seem, if you were looking at the chronology, that I looked at his paper and thought, oh, let's just extend that. But it turned out not quite that way. So let me describe an extremely naive, possibly even dumb way of trying to resolve the situation for the elliptic genus. Sort of a, I can't believe this actually works kind of thing. So, and again, this is so sort of such a silly idea that it occurred to me a long time ago, but it never looked like it was something that was going to work, so I didn't give it any more thought until I randomly stumbled upon it in a completely different context. But I proposed looking at these discrepancies in the following way. It's just sum over ai equals to negative 1, negative di, plus ai not equal to negative 1, ai di. And then just think of this as 1 times negative di. Why not? Because we have some sort of freedom to flip the role of the D's and the A's in the definition of singular elliptic genus. So then, whenever I see coefficient, so then I'm going to pretend that 1 is my coefficient, so that 1 plus 1 is 2, it's not equal to negative 2, 0. So whenever I see one of these coefficients, I'll have them contribute theta of minus di minus 2z, theta of minus di minus z, theta of z, theta of 2z. Just have them contribute that. Replace every instance. Whenever we have a negative 1 coefficient, instead of using that expression, use this expression. Otherwise, use the same expression. So the question is, does this approach work? Namely, if we define the singular elliptic genus this way, is it invariant under, you know, the choice of log resolution? And the answer is, of course not, because there's no way that something that simple-minded could work so, you know, that well. Or at least, I can't imagine that people wouldn't have just done that. But it almost works. And actually, in this approach does work for the simple elliptic singularity. You define the simple elliptic singularity that way, then it is invariant under the choice of log resolution. In general, though, what you have to do is add extra factors which depend on combinatorics associated to the resolution graph. So the reason the answer is very simple for the elliptic singularity is because the resolution graph is very simple. If the resolution graph has pieces that look like this, with a equal to negative 1, then this is going to give us some extra contribution. It turns out we need to add the contribution m, where m is minus the self-intersection number, times theta of a1 plus 1, 2z, theta of a1z, divided by theta of a1 plus 1z squared. This is actually symmetric in terms of a1 and a2. So if we have these kinds of pieces in our resolution graph, we have to add this kind of contribution to our definition for every one of these pieces. And if we do that, then the answer actually, and actually in even more complicated situations, because we also have to account for, we want to do all normal surface singularities, we have to include other factors as well. But if we do that, we can make sense of the singular elliptic genus, and it is invariant under choice of blow-up, and therefore independent of the choice of log resolution. Of course, you know, who cares? Does it have anything to do with the other invariants that we've discussed? Well, it turns out that this, remember I said that Borisov's and Libgaber's approach for defining the elliptic genus of a simple elliptic singularity by using this perturbation by an ample divisor, remember I said that the limit there actually does converge? In fact, it converges to my definition that I've given here. The way to show that is you take the difference of the two quantities, you show that the difference of them is a holomorphic function, and is in fact a weak Jacobi form of weight 0 and index 1. So this is where the modularity properties of the elliptic genus become useful. And there's actually only one such weak Jacobi form, which up to a constant is just the elliptic genus of a K3 surface. It's easy to show that the particular limit of our expression equals 0, which amounts to saying that my definition of the singular Todd genus is equal to their definition of the singular Todd genus, but that's sort of automatic because Todd genus is a birational invariant. So because they produce the same Todd genus, there's a particular limit as the parameter q goes to 0 and z goes to 1. No, q goes to 0 and y... Sorry. If I take the limit as in the elliptic genus as q goes to 0 and z goes to I infinity, I can show that we get back the my Todd genus minus their Todd genus, which is the same Todd genus, which is 0. So this difference is 0. But the Todd genus of the K3 surface is not 0. Therefore, since this thing is up to a constant, the elliptic genus of the K3 surface, the constant has to be 0. Moreover, my definition of the singular elliptic genus gives you a notion of singular chi-y genus. It's natural to ask, does this reproduce the singular chi-y genus defined by Willem Weiss? The answer is yes. And the way to show it is a little bit surprising. The way to do it is to use the Borisov-Libgaber approach, where you pick a particularly convenient perturbation. If you pick the perturbation of the divisors just right, you can get it to converge and converge to my definition of singular elliptic genus. And it turns out that that's the exact same perturbation you need to get the Borisov-Lib-Gabor approach to the singular Chi-Y genus to converge and converge to the Willem-Bass approach. And the reason you need to pick the perturbation in both cases is it's different for both cases, but it ends up having to be the same perturbation. Let me. I realize I'm not making that very clear. So let me. So we have my version of a singular elliptic genus of Z for Z, a normal surface singularity. And then we have the Borisov-Lib-Gabor approach, where when you have this collection of DIs, you introduce a perturbation AI plus epsilon BI. And if you pick the perturbation the correct way, then you can show that this is equal to the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of this elliptic genus of the pair X together with the sum AI plus epsilon BI DI, where this is this with the AI is replaced by this. And in particular, we can also show by picking the right perturbation that if we let the parameter Q go to 0, that this limit is going to equal the definition given in Willem-Bass's approach.
Do you have to multiply with some power of epsilon?
Where?
On the right-hand side, when you let epsilon go to 0.
You mean multiply by epsilon in addition to introducing it here?
Yeah, I mean, don't you get like a 1 over epsilon in this formula? In this?
Yeah, it would appear, but things can cancel. The reason is...
What does it cancel with?
I'll show you. Take the elliptic surface singularity. So we get product xi theta of xi minus z theta of xi, and then theta of e plus theta of e minus epsilon z theta of e minus something like that, right?
Yeah.
So this is some meromorphic function in terms of epsilon. So if you multiply, okay, at some stage you have to talk about multiplying by epsilon just to see what happens, but if you multiply by epsilon and take the limit, this is actually 0. Oh, because, well, this term no longer causes a problem, but now we get theta of e over theta of e minus z times some other factors.
Yeah.
So that becomes, since e is Poincaré dual to the elliptic curve, you get the elliptic genus of the elliptic curve. Neat. So the limit exists, although what it converges to, not so clear, it actually converges to this. Which is the definition that I propose.
And how and why?
Again, I can show that they're the same by looking at the difference, mm-hmm. showing it's a weak Jacobi form. I don't know why. And I don't even know if Willem-Bass knows why it works for some of these situations. I think there's To me, though, the fact that you can interchange the role of the E's, of the divisors and the coefficients, to me that indicates that there's some structure going on there, because obviously this is not really the index of an elliptic operator associated with space, unfortunately. But it almost has that feeling, because it's almost like if this really were like the churn character of something that involved, say, L, you know, di to the ai, you know, it's very clear that we can interchange the roles of the ai's and di's in this case and get the same answer. So to me this indicates there may be some structure left to discover there, but I don't know what that structure is. Just know that this gives you the right answer. And again, I want to emphasize that, so as I was saying, if we pick the perturbation in the case where we have the singularities studied by Willem Weiss, we pick this perturbation just right, then for reasons that have to do with technical conditions on the elliptic genus and its functoriality with respect to blow-up, we have to pick these epsilons in a particular way. But if you want this limit for the case where Q goes to zero to reproduce Weiss stringy chi-y genus, then there's also a technical constraint on how you have to take the perturbation, which is for a completely different reason. Nevertheless, the two constraints end up being the exact same constraint, and that's how I was able to show that the stringy chi-y genus of Willem Weiss is the same as the singular chi-y genus defined by this approach, which I sort of a surprise that it worked out that way. So I think there's something going on there. What it is still open to study. Are there any questions?
I want to come back to the formula on the right. There's the elliptic genus.
This, yeah.
So there's this, the usual elliptic genus up there with the, yeah. So there's this paper by Alvarez and Singer where they derive the elliptic genus in the sigma model as a ratio of certain determinant line bundles on the elliptic curve. And I'm wondering whether you could do the same sort of there, because then kind of the whole thing is suddenly related to the regularization of determinant line bundles and the sections in there. Have you seen anything like this, any approach to do that in your case?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any nice geometric interpretation of the singular elliptic genus. But I believe that at least in certain cases there should be something going on there. It's not always a really well-behaved thing. As I said, it's not just some index of an elliptic operator, or at least not in a... If it is and it isn't, I mean, anything can sort of be described that way, but... Yeah, I don't know.
So how did you... how did you work this out? Did you kind of... Where did you get the formula from in the first place?
I mean, I try to justify it by saying this, right?
Yeah.
Because that's... So you could pretend it was that, but I wish I could say that it was that. It wasn't that at all.
Yeah,
exactly. What happened was this. I was in China, I had nothing better to do, and I thought it might be interesting to compute the equivariant blow-up formula for the elliptic genus for the case where you construct the deformation of the normal cone, you know, in the proof of the deformation of the normal cone, there's a certain kind of blow up, mm-hmm. and the whole point is that you're allowed to, it allows you to relate the data of X, the blow up of X, and then the data of the blow up locus and the exceptional divisor mm-hmm. all get related to each other. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to act on it equivariantly, use the equivariant change of variables formula and see what I get, see if I get anything new. Unfortunately, I didn't get anything new, but I ended up getting a formula that related, because you know, you have your x and you do your x cross p1 mm-hmm. and then you do this blow up, so you're sort of changing the dimensions of things. So when you have these discrepancy coefficients, they all got like shifted by one from what they would normally be. And so I looked at this and I realized, oh wow, I have this formula for the elliptic genus of x, the elliptic genus of the blow-up of x, except that the discrepancy coefficient got shifted by one. And I took various limits of different parameters to see. I was hoping, wow, I wonder if this would be like some crazy way to get around this problem of the discrepancy yeah. coefficients, because I thought maybe if I just blow up, do this kind of deformation of the normal cone trick, I could just shift all the discrepancy and coefficients to whatever I want, by as many as I want, by, you know, doing as many products or whatever as I want. And you know, it turned out that that wasn't really going anywhere, but in the process, I ended up with this formula. And then I realized, well, why am I getting this formula? And that's when I realized, oh, all it really is shifting the role of E in the discrepancy coefficient. So that made me investigate that further. Really, this all started when I decided that for this simple elliptic singularity case, what I did is I computed the stringy Euler number associated to it. And I was absolutely certain that the Borisov-Libgaber stringy Euler number wouldn't be defined. Because in their paper, they say, here's our canonical example of something going wrong. So it just took for granted that that meant that the limit didn't exist. And then much to my surprise and annoyance, the limit did exist, because I was really hoping I was going to be able to say, I have a new invariant that nobody was able to define. So I went ahead and said, OK, well, there's exists. Fine, it's equal to this. Let's see what mine is. Thinking, no way is it going to be the same. And, you know, at least if it's not the same, I know to just do something else. But it was the same. And then I brute force did it for the Chi Y genus. And that was the same. And I thought, okay, let's just see what happens.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Sorry for going over, although technically you did say until 5:30.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it was completely allowed.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Seems like the last day of class is a really busy day for everybody.